Our next guests collaborated on Winter's Bone, a film that won the Grand Jury Prize for Drama at the Sundance Film Festival. It's winding up on a lot of end-of-year top 10 lists, and it tops the Best of 2010 list of our own film critic, David Edelstein. Our guests are Deborah Granick, the director of Winter's Bone, and Daniel Woodrell, the author of the book on which the movie is based. Terry spoke with them earlier this year. Winter's Bone is set in the Ozarks, in a poor community where people have turned to cooking meth to make a living. The main character, Ree Dolly, played by Jennifer Lawrence, is a 17-year-old girl. She's taking care of her two young siblings because her mother is mentally ill and her father, who cooks meth, has gone missing. After being arrested and putting up the family home for his bail bond, he disappears. Unless Ree finds him, she will lose the family's home and have nowhere to go. To find out where her father might be, she goes to the homes of relatives and other people her father knows, most of whom are also in the meth business. They're not interested in talking. In this scene, Ree is looking for Thump Milton, the leader of this meth underworld. As she approaches Thump's house, she's met by his wife, played by Dale Dickey.
You got the wrong place, I expect. Who might you be?
I'm Ree. My dad's Jessup Dolly.
You ain't here for trouble, are you?
No, ma'am.
Because one of my nephews is Buster Leroy, and didn't he shoot your daddy one time?
Yes, but that ain't got nothing to do with me. They settled that themselves, I think.
Shooting him likely settled it. What is it you want?
I got a real bad need to talk with Thump.
And he ain't got no need to talk to you.
But I need to. I really, really got to, ma'am, please. Some of our blood at least is the same. Ain't that supposed to mean something? Isn't that what is always said?
Ain't you got no men could do this?
No, ma'am, I don't.
You go wait in the yard somewhere by that coop. And I'll tell Thump you're here.
That's a scene from Winter's Bone, the movie adaptation by Deborah Granick of Daniel Woodrell's novel. Deborah Granick, Daniel Woodrell, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the man that Ree, the character in that scene, is trying to see Thump. Daniel Woodrell, in your novel, Winter's Bone, you describe him as having a face that's a monument of Ozark stone, with juts and angles and cold-shaded parts the sun never touched. His voice held raised hammers and long shadows. It's a man I don't want to meet. Now that we heard a scene from the film, Daniel Woodrell, let me ask you to do a short reading from the book that the movie's adapted from. And this is another scene in which Ree is trying to find out what happened to her father now that he's skipped bail. And in this scene, she goes to see her father's brother. Would you read that scene for us?
Sure. What's this all about, anyhow? I got to find Dad and make sure he shows in court. That's a man's personal choice, little girl. That's not something you ought to be butting your smarty nose into. Show or don't show, that choice is up to the one that's going to jail to make, not you. Uncle Teardrop was Jessup's elder and had been a crank chef longer, but he'd had a lab go wrong and it had eaten the left ear off his head and burned a savage, melted scar down his neck to the middle of his back. There wasn't enough ear nub remaining to hang sunglasses on. The hair around the ear was gone, too, and the scar on his neck showed above his collar. Three blue teardrops done in jailhouse ink fell in a row from the corner of the eye on his scarred side. Folks said the teardrops meant he'd three times done grisly prison deeds that needed doing but didn't need to be gabbed about. They said the teardrops told you everything you had to know about the man, and the lost ear just repeated it. He generally tried to sit with his melted side to the wall.
That's Daniel Woodrell reading from his novel Winter's Bone, which is adapted to the new film of the same name by Deborah Granick. Daniel, what are some of the things you most wanted Deborah to know about your area that you drew on for the novel and you felt that she needed to understand?
Well, it's been a way of life for a long time. To me, the Ozarks was more or less settled by people who largely wanted to be left alone originally. And there's still just a strong thread of that running through a lot of the people who've been here a while, this sense of privacy and don't ask too many questions about other people's business. And there's so much physical beauty, and yet it's always been difficult to make a living in the Ozarks. So there's a lot of the attendant poverty that goes along with that, and yet it's in such a beautiful setting that I really wanted her to appreciate that.
Deborah, what struck you most that you hadn't seen before?
I feel like I hadn't seen a variety of hand-built houses. That was not familiar to me, or houses that may have had one part built from another form of housing, be it a form of trailer or a kit house, and then additions or small add-ons very much built as needed or as could be afforded. So the texture of people's homes were extremely rich and diverse.
Did you decide to shoot in actual homes?
We did choose to shoot in actual homes. It would have been very difficult feat and probably with very little fruit to like imitate those homes or build a set that replicates it. Instead, we did come to believe that the only way that we would get the film just jammed with visual detail that was very precise and very much from those coordinates where we were filming was to actually go the full tilt and say, could we over time gain access to collaborate with certain families and then work on their properties, film, and that in the end meant like basically from A to Z. It was people's vehicles, their clothing, objects in their home.
Daniel Woodrell, the missing father in your novel Winter's Bone cooks crank, and everyone in the extended family seems to be involved in the business. Why did you want to write about characters who cook and sell meth?
Well, it's been a pretty widespread issue around here for the last 15 or 20 years, I suppose. And from my own house, I could throw a rock and hit meth cook right now. And it's just pretty ingrained, and it's a way to make some quick, easy money. You don't really have to be a master scientist to cook it or anything. And you can turn a quick profit. And at one point, we had a number of people nearby who were engaged. And when they've been using crank for a few days in a row, you don't know what they might do. So, and all manner of things did happen.
Like what?
Well, broad daylight violence. I used to have a neighbor who'd chase his girlfriend, wife with a table leg after he'd been up too long, and broad daylight down the middle of the road, and things like that were happening, petty crime.
So when you saw your neighbor chase his wife with a leg of a table, did you call the police or just let them do their thing?
Yeah. My wife won't let me just stand there if somebody's going after his wife like that. So at one point, in like 2 years, we had six domestics that were so close to our front door, we felt required to be the ones to go out and break it up. And that was all happening then, and it hasn't happened again now in some years. So all associated with the burgeoning of meth in the neighborhood.
Deborah, your previous movie was about a woman who's a coke addict. She was played by Vera Farmiga, and she's the mother of two, just as in your new movie, Ree is the older sister of two children, and she's basically bringing them up on her own. So it's that combination of taking care of children and drugs that hold these two movies together, that and the fact that the word bone is in the title of both of them. So tell us why stories where drugs have an impact on a woman taking care of children are stories that you want to tell.
In these situations, the stakes are just so high when drug use is an issue and children are present, so that the behaviors of a female who is responsible for children, it's just the pressures to do the right thing are even higher. The responsibilities are even higher. And I think that part of what fuels Ree in Daniel's novel is that Chief does feel the stakes are high for her. It's not just whether she could go out and sort of make her way and escape a bad situation, but that she does feel that she has these two young people that are very much tied to her. Their well-being is completely tied to her. And so I feel like in any novel or film, that responsibility, that existential responsibility, if you will, raises the stakes of what that protagonist is going to do, what choices she will make, what moves she'll make.
Daniel Woodrell, in Esquire magazine in 2007, in the Esquire 100 issue, you were number 63, and your entry was written by Benjamin Percy. And I want to quote what he had to say about your novels. He said, "Pick one up and you'll find blood and hay, barbed wire and whiskey, a Ziploc bag of crank. You'll find barroom brawls and trailer park meth labs, guns, a stripper with peroxide blonde hair. These are books for men." Mm. I think that's kind of funny since, Deborah, you adapted one of his books into a movie and really related to the fact that it had a strong woman character. So, Daniel Woodrell, is Ree an unusual character for you? Is it unusual for you to be telling a story from a woman's point of view?
Well, in a way, she's sort of the culmination of, or an elaboration on some female characters I've kind of written about all along, usually in smaller roles. But I think I've always included a lot of women in my books, and they're usually pretty potent women. But in this instance, she just was clearly the straw that stirred everything here. And once I started writing on it, she became more and more prominent, and I realized it was basically going to be all her.
I don't want to give away too much of the movie, so I'll just say here that there is a scene where a couple of women beat up another woman. And then a man basically wants to know, like, did a man hit her? And so one of the women says, this is how she says it in the movie, she says, "No man hit her, I put the hurt on her." And then in the book, the way she says it is, "No man here touched that crazy girl, I drubbed her good myself." So there seems to be almost a code here that, like, bad for a man to hit a woman, okay for a woman to hit a woman. Daniel, is that the code?
Well, I wouldn't say it's code, but I think there might be some ancient perception that that's a fair fight.
Right, right. Is that why you did it that way?
Yes, yes. And I have seen a few women brawls that were every bit as nasty as anything I've seen men do, so it definitely happens.
Where did you witness them?
Just at different establishments around my life and places, and one was in the Ramada Inn parking lot, actually one of the most savage I ever saw in broad daylight.
What happened?
A finger got bit off.
And, whoa!
Yeah, and she spit it at the other woman's foot, and I thought,
oh, no.
I haven't even seen guys do that.
Wow, that sounds...
Well, they were serious.
Sounds like she had some pretty sharp teeth, among other things.
Yeah, she did. She must have had to break it and gnaw a little to get it off.
Daniel, I'm going to ask you to read another page from your novel, Winter's Bone. And in this paragraph, Ree Dolly, your main character, the 17-year-old who's taking care of her two young siblings, is thinking about and worrying about her siblings' future.
Ree's grand hope was that these boys would not be dead to wander by age 12, dulled to life, empty of kindness, boiling with mean. So many Dolly kids were that way, ruined before they had chin hair, groomed to live outside square law and abide by the remorseless, blood-soaked commandments that governed lives led outside square law. There were 200 Dollies living within 30 miles of this valley. Some lived square lives, many did not, but even the square-living Dollies were Dollies at heart and might be helpful kin in a pinch. The rough Dollies were plenty peppery and hard-boiled toward one another, but were unleashed hell on enemies, scornful of town law and town ways, clinging to their own.
So in your novel, Winter's Bone, Ree, the main character, is considering joining the military. You were in the Marines. Why did you enlist?
I was getting in just a little bit of mischief, and it seemed like the military would be a good idea all the way around. So I went in the week I turned 17, and both my parents thought it was a good idea, so it removed me from the scene for a while.
Yeah, but it sounds like it didn't work out the way you expected.
No, there was trouble to be found there as well, and as my father so often said, I found it. So,
when did you start to write? I presume it was after you got out of the Marines?
That's when I began to more seriously investigate it. I was always attracted to the idea. I always loved books, and my mother made sure I knew how to read before I went off to school, and I knew pretty early on that I'd like to be a writer if it was possible. It really wasn't until my early 20s that I really decided to dedicate myself to it full tilt and see if, in fact, you had the ability to do it.
How did you figure out what you were going to write about?
For a long time, I wrote stories about working class life, and I had a professor say, you know, that's always going to be hard when you just do straightforward kind of kitchen sink realism. And as I let that sink in for a couple of years, I began to realize there were other kinds of fiction I also liked that could almost blend. They almost they complemented each other, really.
Who are you thinking
of? Well, social realist fiction and crime fiction have a nice overlap. So I was turned on by all the writers in the canon, but I was also always turned on by James M. Cain and Chandler and Thompson and all the others.
A lot of book critics in their reviews have mentioned that you should be better known than you are. It's kind of like a common refrain about you.
Yes.
I'm sure you've heard that song sung a lot. So, you know, it often works that once a movie's made, if it's adapted from a book, the author of that book becomes a lot better known. Are you hoping for that with this movie?
I think it's unavoidable now, so I've decided to hope for it.
Well, I hope you get it.
Right. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Deborah Granick, congratulations on your new film, Winter's Bone, which is adapted from my other guest, Daniel Woodrell's novel of the same name. Thanks very much to you both.
Oh, thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Filmmaker Deborah Granick and author Daniel Woodrell speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. She directed the movie version of his book, Winter's Bone, and the film is landing on several end-of-year top 10 lists. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.